Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Inside ND Sports Podcast. I'm Tyler James, and I'm joined once again by the one and only Eric Hansen. Together, we cover Notre Dame football recruiting and more for InsideNDSports.com on the Rivals Network. The blue-gold game kicks off Saturday in Notre Dame Stadium. It will be our last chance to learn about next season's football team this spring. The Irish will be entertaining a number of recruits in the 2025 and 2026 classes, and they'll be sharing campus this weekend with returning former football players as part of Legacy Weekend. Hunter Biven, Notre Dame's Assistant Athletics Director for Alumni Relations, played a big role in making Legacy Weekend come to fruition under head coach Marcus Freeman, so we wanted to catch up with Biven again this week. Hunter, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, guys. Appreciate it.
Hunter, this will be the third iteration of Legacy Weekend under Marcus Freeman. How rewarding has it been to be part of this project and see what it's meant to the program?
Yeah, it's been great. Obviously, this was Coach Freeman's vision when he first took over as our head football coach, something that he was really passionate about, both as a former player himself and somebody that understands the challenges that go on with, you know, life after sport and the transition, the identity shift, and somebody who cared deeply about Notre Dame and what Notre Dame stands for. And obviously, the network and our Four for Forever mission and all of those things, that's something that he takes a lot of pride in. So first 2 years, we've had just about 300 former players come back respectively, and we've got about 300 that have signed up again this year. I think last year, the Saturday weather wasn't great. I think it was about 42 and raining, snow sideways. So yeah. We learned that we've got some fair weather football alums that have stood on the sideline for enough frigid football games in Notre Dame Stadium that didn't come to the game. But Legacy Weekend is a whole weekend of events, from everything from a career networking dinner with our current football student athletes to a social on Friday night to a tailgate where our football alums get to interact with our current recruits. As you mentioned, we've got a ton of recruits in town. So it's a whole weekend that our guys are back for, and it's been great.
Hunter, just to give people an idea of what this used to be like before Legacy Weekend, how many alums typically showed up for the Blue Gold Weekend prior to this structure? And then also, is there anybody that you like care to name, to throw some names out there that people would be excited about?
Yeah, so there's always a number of alums that would come back for spring game, and we used to just give them comp tickets, which was a great gesture because we don't do so during the regular season. Obviously, ticket revenue is a big source of revenue for us. We don't do advertising in the stadium, all of those details. So being able to offer comp tickets to our football alums for the spring game was a good gesture for us. So we would get a good number that would bring their families back and be able to walk them around without the craziness of game day and all of those different things like that. So we would have a good number. But to get a little deeper, this idea of having an organized alumni event, weekend, whatever, it actually went back to Ron Paulus actually created this as a former player networking dinner when I was playing. I think 2015 was the first year that we did it, and he would just bring back some prominent alums who had, gone on to achieve some really great professional success in different career industries, from finance to management to accounting to, you know, whatever. And he would bring back, and it was just a cool way to get some networking experience from a career standpoint that didn't feel, you know, stuffy, manufactured, like those kinds of events tend to feel from time to time. You had a good mix of telling old war stories and connecting over, you know, this coach yelled at me for this reason. Oh, I walked in those shoes. Like, I walked through 3 feet of snow for a 6 minute workout in the same way that you did, along with just some helpful tips on how to get started and life after Notre Dame. So that was kind of the genesis of creating this. And then obviously, like I said, Coach Freeman came in and gave the fuel to the fire to turn it into what it is today. But for some notable names, we've got about 10 NFL guys coming back. Aaron Banks is coming back. Miles Boykin, Liam Eichenberg, Cole Kmet, Quentin Nelson, Julian Okorah, Pro Pride Jr., Chris Smith, Jerry Tillery, and Drew Tranquil. Obviously, Drew will celebrate Him and his Super Bowl win, we might have him and Banksy do a one-on-one out there, just for, for his Kansas City and do a Super Bowl remake. But those are some notable names from NFL guys. Obviously, having those guys around to interact with our recruits on Saturday morning is a pretty valuable asset for us. But we've also got a really great number of guys who maybe didn't go on to achieve awesome things in the NFL, but are really valuable assets for us in the career in the network space. Byron Sporrell is on the board of trustees. He's going to speak during our networking dinner. Tracy Graham comes back every year. Pat Eilers, those types of guys coming back is just an awesome example for our guys to look at and what the Four for Forever mission is and what life after Notre Dame can look like if they buy into to all the things that we stand for.
Hunter, is there a moment or two that you were either part of or witnessed that really stood out to you of just sort of watching sort of the past sort of connect with the present at Notre Dame?
I don't know if there's an exact moment, but something different that we do that was Coach Freeman's initial idea that I was a little hesitant about as the person that's organizing it and communicating this vision is that we don't allow families or guests to come back for Legacy Weekend. It's just the guys, which is met with some contention at first, but then when our alums get back and realize, this weekend is 100% dedicated to connecting with fellow former players and our current team. It's a pretty valuable vision and something that guys really buy into. So kind of seeing the guys that I've exchanged heated emails back, I don't know if I'm exchanging emails with them or their wives. But when seeing those guys come back and buy into what we're looking for there is a pretty cool thing. And especially on the Friday night event, the social, it's just all the former players in the Shiv, in the North Tunnel. We've got an open bar, buffet, everybody just living it up with the guys. Like that's a pretty cool sight to see.
And there's going to be a media version of that too. I'm just kidding.
We'll get that on the books. That'd be a fun one. That'd be good.
So with this comes the blue gold game, and I know that you had some injury issues and medical issues in different times and amazing things that you overcame. But in playing in these blue gold games as a player, what did you get out of it, and what do you think the coaches get out of it, if anything? Or is it more for the fans?
Yeah, for me, obviously I played with I think five eventual first round draft pick offensive linemen. So we had a lot of competition in the O-line room. Obviously we were brothers and we were a unit and everything, but just having that much talent in one room, you were competing for a spot at all times. So spring ball for me was always my opportunity to get in there and earn a starting spot. And I did so a couple of times and then had whatever happened with my heart and back and all that kind of stuff happen. But that was spring was always not a stressful time for me, but was always a big important part of my year. So I think that's probably the most value that you gain from spring practice, more so than the game. Obviously the game is the game. It's manufactured, it's 2 hours, it's on Peacock and all those things. But spring practices, you can really get out there and get after it and not have to worry about getting ready for a game on Saturday. You get a day in between each practice, so you have a recovery day. So you can get out there and give it everything you've got to try to go and earn a starting spot. That's what spring practice does to me.
Following up on that, the media, we get to see snippets of practice, and then we had the one right at the beginning, and we had the jersey scrimmage last Saturday. So we've seen some of the team. For an average fan, this is their only look this spring. And a lot of them are going to be looking at that offensive line. And so my question is, as a former offensive lineman, how difficult is it to really see progress of that unit when it's split up? You're going to have twos and ones and threes all mixed together.
It's next to impossible.
Okay.
Offensive line, the offensive line is, and obviously I'm biased here, but it's the only position in sports overall, not just football, where five individuals literally have to be able to predict each other's movement on every single play. And if they don't, then the person behind them is going to have to pay the price for it. So that continuity is everything. And if I learned anything of playing offensive line under Harry Hustand and playing at Notre Dame, it's that the strength of the unit is the strength of the individual, right? Like you can go out and say, oh, that guy's got a nice pass set, or oh, that guy had a nice block on that. But if he turns around the next play and doesn't communicate with his guard next to him or what have you, then you're going to look bad and give up a sack. So it's really hard to evaluate the offensive line from a spring game. Like you can go out there and try to put five together and like, oh, this pairing might be good, or this guy might be better at this position. This is a good opportunity for us to put him in there and get some reps in there. You can gain some value there. And there is value in going into a quasi game situation where, you know, the coaches aren't out there. You're just out there playing ball, 2 minute situation, real life game situation. There's value to gain there, but from an actual evaluation of how good our offensive line is going to be, I don't think you're going to get that from the spring game.
Well, I don't know how many practices you've been at this spring, Hunter, but what have you seen from Notre Dame's offensive line progression in the practices this spring?
I've actually been out there for a number of reasons. We actually just hired my older brother Harris
Right.
as our tight ends analyst. So I've been out there making sure he's doing what he's supposed to, and giving him some critique and making sure he's doing things the Notre Dame way. But it's a good looking unit. You know, we've got a really, really good contingency of young guys that are going to be really, really good. Billy Shrouth is going to be really, really good. Ashton Craig, Charles Jagasaw, I've been really, really impressed with those guys. I mean, they look so, so good this spring, and I'm really excited to get out there and watch them compete. Emil Wagner has been really fun to watch. Pat Coogan as kind of the elder of the group, watching his leadership blossom into what it is. Tosh Baker out there battling every day on the edge. You know, it's a good, really solid group. You don't have any, you know, you always hear about these military groups. You've always got one bad egg kind of spoils the group, and it's kind of the same mantra with offensive line. I don't think we have any bad eggs in this group, so that's promising to see.
Okay, I'll make a comment about Harris, and then I've got an offensive line question.
Yep.
Harris's Twitter picture, if that's all you ever saw, if you're a little kid, you avoid his house on Halloween. He looks all business. He would scare. If I were the tight ends, I'm obey. I say I'm not worried about Mike Denbrock. I'm worried about
Yeah.
Harris
No
Bevan.
doubt. Yeah.
But as far as the offensive line evolution, so they get through the blue gold game. What happens with that group this summer? What happens at fall camp? I mean, when does chemistry start to form? When do you really need to stop the position competitions per se and really hone in on what you were talking about before, the five guys knowing each other's movements? Because the Neil's still trying to move into the ones. I know Rocco's trying to get up there.
Yep. I think summer especially is more of just honing in on your craft, doing drills off the field, pass sets, coming off blocking, you know, blocking shields and stuff like that. Coach Rudolph has got a really great regimen of drills and stuff that those guys will go through this summer, getting in shape, focused on strength and conditioning. And really you want the summertime to be a time that they're 100% focused on getting their body ready for the grind of the season. So it's also a good time for you to step away from football a little bit. So there's not a ton of time for them to build that continuity that we were talking about. I think, you know, week one, week two of training camp, you should have a good picture of what your offensive line is going to look like on week one. Obviously, injuries and everything like that are going to happen. It's five guys out there bashing their head against each other on every play. But I think training camp is really where you're going to find out what the offensive line is going to look like and where that continuity is built.
Hunter, I wanted to follow up with a question about your brother. What has it been like to see him coming to Notre Dame? What has it been like? He's your older brother, so I'm curious what your guys' relationship is and was like as brothers, and what's it
Yeah.
like sort of being the younger brother, sort of welcoming him into to Notre Dame, which is your place, and
Yeah.
someone obviously he's familiar with, but doesn't have the same relationship
Yeah.
that you do.
Yeah, it's been a dream come true. We were both massive Notre Dame fans growing up. We didn't have cable growing up, so NBC getting Getting to watch NBC and watch Notre Dame every Saturday was something that we look forward to with our dad. And we have some really special memories watching Notre Dame football with our dad. My dad wasn't a Notre Dame fan at all, but he would watch it with us. And obviously, we lost our dad when we were young. I was 14. My brother was just leaving for college when we lost our dad. So it's a cool memory in that respect. We haven't lived in the same zip code since high school. We lost our dad. My brother went to college in the same summer, and so since that time, he played at Murray State. He went on to coaching. I've been at Notre Dame. Mom moved back to Tennessee, so we've been kind of a fractured family for 10 years now, almost over a decade. Not getting to see each other a lot. So, and my brother's my best friend in the world, always has been. So it's been really, really cool. We actually, my wife and I just had a newborn baby girl in January too. So we had our baby girl, and then literally that same week, we found out that Harris was going to come up from LSU. So it's a dream come true, and things are aligning, and it's been really, really cool. From a Notre Dame standpoint, I think we got a hell of a football coach. Just a guy that cares about his guys, cares about his craft. He's not a guy that, wants to go be a head football coach. He cares about the fundamentals of the game, and he cares about developing young people and building the fundamentals and instilling the things that are important in college football that unfortunately it seems like are going by the wayside more and more by the day here. So I'm excited for us personally to have my big brother here and my best friend here. But also from a Notre Dame alum, graduate, fan, homer, whatever you want to call me, we got a hell of a football coach. So I'm excited for that as well.
If he's really your best friend, he's changed some diapers by now. That's all I
Yes, he
have
absolutely has.
to say. So my next question has to do with Harris and Mike Denbrock. First of all, what's it like having Mike Denbrock back? He w coached a couple different positions while you're here, tight ends at the beginning of his time with Brian and then wide receivers. So what's that like? And then obviously with Mike roving around and trying to deal with all the positions, Harris's position is kind of elevated. Can you talk about that?
It's awesome having Coach Denbrock back. He was my offensive coordinator for 2 years, including the 2015 season where we had perhaps the best offensive line ever in college football with Q and Mike and Ronnie and Nick and all of those guys and CJ Procise running behind us. That was a really fun year with Deshaun at the helm, and we were really, really good that year. So we had a lot of fun on offense, and I still say it to this day, Mike Denbrock and Harry Hiestand are neck and neck for who gives the best pregame speeches. So we would get it at the hotel from Coach Denbrock, and then right before we would get it from Coach Hiestand. So by the time we were running out of the tunnel, it was like literally ready to run through a brick wall. So really awesome to have Coach Denbrock back. I think he's the best offensive coordinator in college football, and excited to see what he's going to be able to do with the talent that he has on the offensive side of the ball this year. And for Harris to expand on that. Important role. He's in an analyst position, so he's an off the field position coach technically. He doesn't do much on field in terms of coaching the drills, but he is overseeing that group when Coach Denbrock is doing his offensive coordinator responsibilities and stuff like that. So it's a cool, really great opportunity for a young coach to get in there and get some cool experience with those guys.
Hunter, you mentioned Harry Hiestand earlier, and I think anyone who's a Notre Dame fan knows his reputation as an offensive line coach. And I think if you're a fan and pays attention, I think you also know his reputation of being a very fiery coach too. I'm curious from your perspective, post career, what has your relationship been like with Harry Hiestand? How valuable has he been to you and someone to reach out to or to have a relationship after your playing career?
Yes, Coach Hiestand was like a father figure for me. He had a unique way of coaching. He got his point across and was very clear. You always knew exactly where you stood with Coach Hiestand, which I've learned on this side of the business is few and far between. There's not a ton of coaches who are that way, so it's made me appreciate that even more in our relationship afterward. But just the sense of urgency and the pride that you take in doing your job, whatever that job may be, whether if it's as a professional or a husband or a father, the urgency and the pride that you take to everything that you do is something that I learned from Coach Hiestand, and I'll never forget that. And being a consistent figure of accountability and being somebody that people can rely on and trust, and the importance of that is something that I learned from Coach Hiestand. It's something that he instills in every single player that he coached. I'll take that to my grave, and that's something that, I wouldn't trade for anything. We still have an incredible relationship. He's still in town. He lives just north of the border in Niles, Michigan. His daughter Sarah is playing soccer at Illinois, and his son just graduated from the Air Force Academy. So they've stuck around here. He bounces around and does his thing. He's not a guy to sit still and not do anything. So he's going around and seeing all of his disciples that are coaching all over the country and everything like that. So whenever he's in town, we grab coffee whenever we can, and he's always somebody that I can call to just get, if nothing else, brutally honest advice about whatever it may be, whether it's, something in my marriage or something in being a young father or something with my family or brother or professionally. If nothing else, he's going to give his honest and seasoned experienced opinion about it. So that's been a really awesome resource to have, even after playing for him.
Last one from me, Hunter. Can you tell the people, besides arranging the legacy weekend and watching the offensive line and keeping tabs on your brother, what your role is at Notre Dame now, and how often do you interact with the new athletic director, Pete Bevakwa?
Yep. So, in my new role, overseeing all of our alumni relations, it's building, maintaining, and strengthening relationships with our over 13,000 living student athlete alumni at Notre Dame. Turns out people who went to Notre Dame really love Notre Dame. So that gets really busy at times, and people giving their two cents after we make a certain play call or something like that. A lot of it is responding to emails, talking on the phone, hosting folks. But also really focused on the connection that population has with our current student athletes, and really bringing that four for forever Notre Dame network to life, and bringing it down to earth so it's something tangible that our current student athletes can rely on, and something tangible that our former student athletes can rely on in their next 40, 50, 60 years after they leave Notre Dame. So finding avenues to do that and support that population is something that I'm focused on every day. In terms of my relationship with Pete, it's something that he's really, really passionate about, and something that he recognizes is going to continue to distinct Notre Dame athletics long term as our industry becomes more and more transactional by the day. That's something that's going to be an even bigger value add in our recruiting pitch, and what's going to make Notre Dame set itself apart from other schools in the country. That part of Notre Dame and the Notre Dame student athlete experience is never going to change. It's been valuable for a long time, and I think it's going to be even more valuable here as we settle into our new era of college athletics.
Well, all right, Hunter, that's all we have for you today. We appreciate you taking time to join us. Hopefully, you get to enjoy the fruits of your labor this weekend. And with the little one at home, you're able to find some sleep every now and then, too.
Appreciate that.
Before we get to our question segment, I wanted to share a new subscription deal available for InsideNDSports.com. If you buy a 1 month subscription to the site, you'll get 3 additional months for free by using promo code NDSpring24. That's ND as in Notre Dame, spring as in the season, and 24 as in the year. The promotion ends soon on Monday, so don't miss out on this chance to gain access to our premium analysis and recruiting coverage and all of our discussions over on the Insider Lounge. You can also find a link to the deal in the podcast description or show notes. Remember, that's promo code NDSpring24. All right, now it's time for questions. You can submit questions to us on Twitter or the Insider Lounge message board before every podcast. I'm at TJamesND and Eric's at EHansenND. First one I have for us, Eric, is from LDL Go Irish on the Insider Lounge. LDL says, "I know the blue gold game can be somewhat vanilla at times, but I am really looking forward to it. I especially want to see the offensive line and how they perform individually and as a team. How will the line be split? I was hopeful that a couple second stringers will get a chance to run with some of the ones. Marcus Freeman has said the competition for the best five will head into summer camp. Do you think we will see some twos running with the ones after the draft today?
So Hunter kind of answered this a little bit earlier. It's going to be split up. And so I don't think you're going to get, that's why I asked the question. I don't think you're going to get a really good picture about continuity and chemistry and that kind of stuff, because it's going to be a lot of guys that aren't used to be working next to each other. I think you'll be able to see some individual skills and so forth. I don't think this is a total wash, but in terms of, are they going to be good on August 31st versus are they going to be struggling and whoever's the quarterback going to be on their back a lot? I don't think we're going to get a great indication of that on Saturday.
Yeah, and I can run through the draft. I think I have this all correct. The blue team consists of Emil Wagner, Sullivan Absher, Ty Chan, Sam Pendleton, Billy Shrouth, Pat Coogan, and Peter Jones. And then the gold team has Charles Jagusa, Anthony Knapp, Ashton Craig, Joe Otting, Rocco Spindler, Chris Tarrick, and Tosh Baker. I think I have that right. So what we're seeing there is the two starting center, projected starting tackles are both playing to get on the same team. The two starting guards are on the same team. Then the tackles have the starting center. Now, obviously, that's just projection. I thought it was interesting that Emil Wagner was drafted so high that yeah. I mean, it does sort of correlate with how they can sort of put the team together when Tosh Baker's on one team, because they put seniors all together on, or they assign seniors to teams and they split them up. So then if someone has Tosh Baker, then obviously their need is at left tackle rather than right tackle. So that influences how the draft works as well. But so we'll see a mix and matching of guys. I think, I don't know that Notre Dame has a lot of O-linemen that desert or that are like in a position where it's like, okay, we only need to see you for one series. I think we're going to see a lot of action for most of those guys because they're all, except for, I think Ashton Craig is probably the one who's the safest in his job, but I think they're all pretty actively still battling for their positions. All right, next is a question from Chris Mayer at Bengals Chase. Do we think Steve Angeli transfers? And if so, does CJ Carr or Kenny Minchie take the number two role?
I think Tyler and I are probably a little bit divided on this. I still say no, but I wouldn't be surprised with either outcome. I don't think there's as many great options for him this summer as there would have been in December, January. But I mean, he may just say, you know what? I want to start somewhere. I think I can find some place to do that. If I were advising him and he has not asked my advice, I would say, you know what? Just play this season, see how it plays out. You may win the job. Riley Leonard may get hurt, and then you can always transfer after the season. If he did transfer, I would say Minchie goes into the summer as number two and CJ Carr as number three. And I think I love Kenny Minchie and I love his upside, but I think Carr would overtake him eventually.
Yeah. With Angeli, I don't know what he's going to do. I'm not pretending that I do. I'm not like saying I'm not certain, but I do know what's going to happen. Like I really don't know what's going to happen. I think there's a chance he stays. When it comes to backup quarterbacks in college football right now, I think it's, I don't want to ever assume that they're going to stay. I just think that the allure of leaving is so attractive.
Tyler Buckner told us that last year. I mean, that it's kind of a similar situation than as last year.
Exactly. If Angeli leaves, I still don't know that you can put Carr ahead of Minchie until like you need him to play, right? Because like if you put Carr ahead of Minchie, then Minchie's leaving in December, right? Like why would Minchie stick around now? Minchie could definitely choose to do that and say, you know what, nothing is over yet. Like I can still win this job going into next season. But if Minchie then leaves and Angeli has already left, then you could potentially be going into next spring with CJ Carr and Deuce Knight as your quarterbacks on the roster. And that seems like a precarious position to be in. So I think it's a juggling act that I think you have to be very careful about. And that's why I said, like, is there any, what is the upside to making CJ Carr the two during the season? And I don't know I mean, I guess the one thing is like, well, if you really think he's going to be your starter next year and you're that convicted of it, then you maybe feel like you need to get him more experience this year. But it's a delicate situation, and I don't. I'm glad I'm not the one that has to handle it all.
Yeah, and I'm telling you, I would not write off Kenny Minchie at
No,
all in
yeah.
any situation. He has talent. There is talent there. He's not polished, he's not consistent, but there's talent.
All right, next question is from Mike Sheehy at ND Mike 70. There's been a lot of praise in recent years for the receiver and tight end blocking downfield. It helps with the run game and receivers' yards after catch. Does the importance slash value change under Mike Dembrock's offensive scheme or with a different makeup of wide receivers?
It's always a big deal. It was when Dembrock was here before, and he was the receivers coach. It was when he was at LSU. I mean, he wants well-rounded receivers, receivers that can do everything. So I don't think anything changes as far as that. I mean, and then so yeah, for me, it's going to be emphasized, I guess not at the expense of something else, but again, he's going to teach that and emphasize it. And I don't think that there are unwilling participants on the wide receiver unit that I've seen.
Yeah, I the only thing that I thought was in terms of like a difference between this year and last year is that maybe we see less. Like, I don't remember if you remember, like, at times last year, like, there'd be big blocks on safeties coming from the receivers that would help spring some runs. And that was a very intentional part of the scheme that Notre Dame had drawn up in its run game. I don't know how involved Notre Dame's receivers will be in something specifically like that. And then also, sort of like the counterplay that Notre Dame ran a lot last year, a receiver, Jaden Thomas, was the best at it. Played a big role in being sort of a lead blocker in there. I don't know that we're going to see those similar kinds of situations in Mike Denbrock's offense, but I don't, that doesn't mean like the value or importance of receiver blocking will decrease. I think there's just going to be different ways to probably impact the edges more than it would having some impacts on the interior between the numbers or between the hashes this season. But I still think it's going to be important for Notre Dame's offense to get longer runs, to spring other receivers for longer yards after the catch, as Mike mentioned. So I do think it'll be a something that will be placed in a, with an important value, but the scheme might not be one that uses it in the same sort of way. All right, at IrishNet asks, can you rate Jaden Greathouse on a scale of 1 to 10 thus far into practices? Hearing nothing but great things everywhere.
Well, we've seen him in two full practices and then little snippets of drills and other ones. I'm not good with this number thing because I think the numbers, I'm going to come up with one because I think the numbers mean something to everybody. But let me warn you, I taught Italian to my son's youngest son's fourth grade class, and every kid in that class got an A. So,
Then maybe that just means you're a good teacher.
yeah, yeah, there you go. I'm a great teacher. I'll say an 8, and let me give it some context. I think he looks better than last year. I think he looks strong. He runs good routes. He makes athletic plays. There's a lot to like about him, and I think he complements Jordan Faison really well. So that 8 to me is a good number, but I'm not sure that whether that's too high or too low in terms of numbers.
I went with a 9. I mean, I've been very impressed with him. I think he's this spring, in terms of what we've seen, been Notre Dame's best right wide receiver. I
Correct.
th think he, like, regardless of what grade we put on him, I think a lot of people would probably agree on that that aren't on this podcast. But I think he's been very well rounded. He seems to ex be expanding his game. Mike Denbrock's been high on like his versatility and their ability, like. And this is something I was sort of harping on last year. Like, Jaden Greathouse was still playing after his hamstring issue, but he then, because of Jordan Faison, he was moved outside. And I just don't think Jaden Greathouse was in a position to be able to succeed as an outside receiver last year. But Notre Dame believes now he is putting himself in a position to do that. And so I think he'll probably be a very versatile piece in Notre Dame's passing game. And he just has a knack for getting open that, whether it's man coverage or zone coverage. He was such a prolific receiver in high school that I think that has obviously helped his career and sort of just having the experience and knowing how to use his body to get open and knowing what defenses are trying to do to take advantage of openings in the defense. So I think I'm very high on Jaden Greathouse and have been impressed with what he's done this spring.
He's really good on contested catches, in part what Tyler said. He uses his body so well to shield the ball away from the receiver, and he's strong. If he had to pull it away from him, I would bet on him.
All right, next question is from Nathan Reynolds at Enforcers 2117. So I'm guessing after seeing the Jersey scrimmage on Saturday between the offense and defense scoring touchdowns and pick sixes, the only logical conclusion is that Bryce McPherson doesn't think he will get much playing time and would rather go somewhere else so he can punt a lot.
LOL, he said.
LOL. Sorry, I forgot the LOL.
Yeah, and you chuckled. So, not based on the scrimmage because the defense won the scrimmage. It's a bit of a head scratcher why he left. He's a really good athlete. He would have been really good on fake punts, and had a very good raw punting average. He needed to get into the nuances of it, and he probably will wherever he's going. I think it's a great opportunity for someone who wants to be on a team contending for a playoff. So whether they want Eric Goins to do this or the kid, 30-year-old from Citadel that's been in the military, whose NCAA clock paused while he was in the military, or go out and get somebody else in the portal, I think they'll have a good punter.
Yeah, I think the portal would make sense. I don't know what I honestly don't know what direction they're going at in this point. I mean, I think Notre Dame was aware of this situation, but I don't know that this was necessarily something Notre Dame would have chosen for itself. Yeah, it's a weird one that I mean, I don't think he was like an invincible punter on Notre Dame's team. Like he was being pushed and challenged, but there was no indication from any of the practices that we saw that he had sort of lost his job. I think he's a good punter, had plenty of room to improve. He was someone that, I mean, I looked at the transcript of the questions that he was asked both by reporters, beat reporters that are writers, and then also the video folks. When he was available earlier this spring, and he was not asked about Bryce McPherson's like job as a punter. The only time he was asked about him was like his ability to potentially do kickoffs, because that was something that he came to Notre Dame with a reputation of being able to do, and hasn't done that at Notre Dame. He was actually in position to do that as a freshman, but then hurt his groin, and Zach Yoakum took over those responsibilities in 2022, and then the focus has been on his punting career. So, Bryce must be looking for something else that he doesn't feel like he can get at Notre Dame, and Notre Dame is going to need to address if it feels confident with the punters on its roster, or if it needs to bring someone else in. All right, next question is from at Henry Bede, and it's a series of questions. So let's take these one at a time. Should Notre Dame pursue transfer wide receiver Tyler Williams, who they offered out of high school?
Unless there's a run of receivers leaving in the portal in the next week and a half, I don't know why you would need a 12th wide receiver.
Yeah, I don't think so. And it's not like he was someone that was close to committing to Notre Dame. I don't think he ever visited. I mean, Chancey Stuckey was the one recruiting him. So I'm not really sure there's a common ground to start from, even if he felt like he was someone that you wanted to add, that was talented enough to add to your team. So I don't necessarily anticipate that changes, but I just don't know that he's necessarily a natural fit for Notre Dame. Adam Gorney, our national rivals. Director of recruiting reported that he's hearing that Williams is interested in Florida State, UCF, Colorado, and Michigan. So Notre Dame's not on that list. I don't think they'll be added to it, but we'll let you know if it does. All right. Next question from Henry was, could Sullivan Abshur or Gurbby Lambert become players in the right tackle competition?
I don't think Abshur could beat either of those guys out, Emil Wagner or Tosh Baker, or he'd already be in that competition. I just think he's behind them at this time. I mean, he's younger. His body isn't quite as developed as theirs is. And I think he's, for him to be, you know, taking reps at number two left tackle, I think is a good place to be. Lambert is a stud. I mean, he's an incredible talent. I don't know how hammer ready he is, but I mean, physically 6'7" and he's over 300. He's a prodigy, but I think a good starting place for him is trying to get into the two deeps by the time the season starts. I don't think he's going to win the right tackle spot.
Yeah, I think it would be hard for either of them to sort of jump two guys that have been repping at right tackle. Now, maybe one of them is in a position to say if those guys are struggling in the season, replace them. But I just don't think like coming into the season as a potential first game starter that either of them would make a lot of sense. I don't, and especially if you're going to have Charles Jagasaw as your other starting tackle, like that would be two very inexperienced offensive tackles. Which I mean, even if Emil Wagner wins the job at the right tackle spot, he's pretty inexperienced, even though he's older in the program. But yeah, I don't, I just don't see that happening. Maybe, but I have my doubts right now. Next question: what is the difference between the Aztec and Rover positions?
Aztec starts with an A. No, I'm just kidding. Aztec is a niche position. It's a safety-ish type position used in special third down package called the spear. And DJ Brown was the guy that was the Aztec last year. And it may be Jaden Osbury this year. They may actually go with a linebacker, but kind of playing in a safety role. Rover is a linebacker position in ND's base defense. And the only guy that really has consistently been a three down Rover has been Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah. Ideally, that's what you'd like to develop. And Osbury's got a chance to do that. I think they'd like Jalen Snead to be able to do that. But yeah, one is in a base defense linebacker. Another is kind of a special package safety.
Yeah. And the only thing I would add to that is like Rover should be a better run defender because it's a base defense. You're probably not going to see an Aztec on a first down. Because it's more of a third down situation or a pass heavy down situation, whereas a Rover would be a more well rounded linebacker and someone that could help support both in the run and in the pass. Last question from Henry Bede was: who will be the sack leader, or who will lead the team in sacks in 2024?
I got asked this on our WSBT radio show, was a Twitter question of the day. And I went outside the box and picked, and I feel much better about it after Saturday. I picked Boubacar Traore.
Yeah, I think I like that. I think that would be great if he's in a position to play at that level, because it seems like the talent is there. It's just a matter of if he can be a well-rounded defender that they trust to put in those situations. I think it could go any number of ways. I mean, the odds-on favorite would probably be Jordan Botello, given the opportunity that he'll have. Joshua Burnham, I think, would probably be my sort of dark horse pick. Like, if I'm not saying Botello, I'd probably say Burnham, because I just think he has the versatility to rush in different situations, and I just like him as, like, a well-rounded pass rusher. And then another one could be like Jalen Snead. I think he's going to be given some opportunities to rush the passer when he's put in there in passing situations. And so there could be a chance for him to be the sack leader. So I'm not doing a very good job of like having a definitive answer.
I think that's probably why, because I think it's going to be spread out. There's going to be a lot of guys with several, not somebody like Isaiah Foskey that piles up double digits.
Right. Yeah. I think it'd probably be pretty split, but if I had to put money on someone, I'd probably just go the safe route with Jordan Botello, but I would advise to not put money on such a prediction.
I'll tell you, speaking of young linebackers, it was kind of interesting to me today. Now, Kaiser was already assigned to a team because he's a senior, but Kingston Villiamuasa was the first linebacker off the board.
And was that to Kaiser's team? I don't remember. Do you remember?
I believe it was. I can look at my notes here. No, it was actually on the team opposite of him.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I don't. So I'm sure there's probably some behind the scenes dealings or discussions like, hey, we'd really like to see Drake Bowen play next to Jack Heiser. I don't know if that's what happened, but that could certainly be a possibility too. So I don't want to rule that out. And that's not to doubt
Well, and
Pink's finish.
there was a trade involving linebackers. The proposed trade was Jay Nosbury, who was on the blue team, for either KVA or Jalen Snead, and they did swap Snead and Osbury. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
So I listen, I love Kingston Viliamuasa. I think he has a very bright future, and I think he's gonna impact Notre Dame's defense in ways this season. I've also liked the spring that Drake Bowen has had too. So it's gonna make for quite the interesting linebacker group this season for Notre Dame.
And one other thing from the draft, if you have Dylan McCullough come speak to your Notre Dame club, you may want to have a 7 second delay.
Don't run it live. He will maybe throw a swear word in there. That's good stuff. Next question is from at Charles W. Wolf. Speaking of Saturday's game, who is your pick for Junior Jabby breakout star on Saturday?
So breakout star, actual breakout star, or breakout star never to be heard from again. So if it's somebody like Junior Jabby that's never to be heard from again, it would probably be somebody that's a walk-on at a position that's a little bit thin. So I went with, to not demean anybody, I went with Henry Garrity, since I covered his dad in basketball, Pat Garrity. Sometimes those walk-on tight ends get some opportunities, and then they don't end up, playing very much during the season because Notre Dame has six on scholarship. As an actual breakout player, and there have been so many that have broken out already during spring, I went with two guys that haven't gotten a lot of written about. I'm going to go with KK Smith, who's a number two wide receiver right now. And my kind of plan B guy would be Aeneas Williams, because I think he's got a lot of talent and he's at a very deep position, but he may be in a situation in the blue gold game where he gets a lot of carries late and looks good.
I agree with your like breakout stars that would actually potentially lead to something. In terms of the Junior Jabby Award, my prediction is Justin Fisher, a walk-on from locally Mishawaka High School, running back. He did some nice things in the scrimmage we saw late, with some of the third string guys in there. So that's who I would go with. I'm curious, like, why do you think Junior Jabby has such a lasting legacy? Is it his would his name would it would he be as remembered if he was Rob Williams or something, like, if he didn't have such an interesting name? Do you think that is part of his legacy? I like, this is before my time covering Notre Dame, but I have heard plenty about Junior Jabby, and it's funny to me that he has had such a lasting legacy among the Notre Dame fan base.
There's a couple things. One is you get a lot of people that overdid it that actually predicted that this would.
Oh, really?
So you have some media that don't normally cover the Notre Dame, but that would come to the spring game and a few home games, and they maybe went off the deep end with Junior Jabby. And there have been other guys like that. And I think it's just kind of a cautionary tale not to read way too much into the blue gold game. I think his name also, Junior Jabby, and he has since legally changed it to Abraham.
Oh, okay.
He would be an interesting story. Then he transferred twice. He transferred to a FCS school, Delaware. Then he transferred to a Division II school in Pennsylvania. So it's quite the tale. But I think his name being Junior Jabby, he was recruited in one of the worst recruiting classes ever during the Tyrone Willingham era. So, I mean, there's just all kinds of karma. And I bet he's a wonderful person.
All right. Next question is from Marie Biafore at Biafore
More
underscore.
than you wanted.
No, that was good. No, I
Okay.
appreciate that. But he comes up all the time.
You sounded tired.
No, sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry. I should have done a better job responding. Maybe I was just wary of this question that's coming from Marie. Her questions are, do you think that there are too many developmental players in the 2025 class? Also, if Deuce Knight does not come to Notre Dame, what do you think the backup plan would be?
I'm good with, I don't, I wouldn't characterize it as too many developmental players. And even if there are, were developmental players, you have the transfer portal now, which is kind of gets you out of a spot where maybe you have a position group that's young and that is going to take some time to develop. So I don't think that would even be a concern if it were the case. I'm going to defer to Tyler on the Deuce Knight thing. I'm not sure who they double back on.
Yeah, well, let me start with the second one. I don't necessarily know what the backup plan would be. I think you'd have to check in on Barrett Bachmeyer, who has since committed to Stanford. That was someone that was close to potentially committing to Notre Dame, and it was almost like a race to see who would commit first between Barrett Bachmeyer and Deuce Knight. But after that, I think you'd probably have to circle back and offer some new quarterbacks. I don't know if there's any other guys that Notre Dame has previously offered that would make a lot of sense to be interested in Notre Dame again. As for too many developmental players in the 2025 class, Marie asks us very good questions all the time, and I'm appreciative of that. But it feels like she's trying to come up with ways to have us criticize the 2025 class. She comes at it from different angles, and I'm running out of ways to share my thoughts on the 2025 class. I guess my question in response would be, what do you class what? What exactly do you view as a developmental player? Does that mean a three-star recruit? In my opinion, you can have four-star recruits that are developmental. Like I would say Deuce Knight is a developmental player because he's a raw prospect as a quarterback. Like, I don't think Deuce Knight is someone you can expect to come in and start as a freshman at Notre Dame. But that doesn't mean he's any less of a recruit. I think he's a phenomenal recruit and has a very enticing potential that comes with him. If you want to take it on its value in terms of like three-star recruits, I think Notre Dame has taken too many three-star wide receivers. I that's something I've talked about before, that I wondered if they maybe are taking too many. And the positive side of that is, like, it seems to me as long as Notre Dame can get to five that they like, I think they will take five. But they have to obviously finish there. So there's some four-star recruits at the receiver position that Notre Dame has a chance with, like Derek Meadows and Tanook Hines, that Notre Dame is continuing to work for. The defensive line class, I mean, Rivals has those guys ranked as four stars, like Dominic Hulak and Joseph Reef. I think they're both probably guys that are, they're not going to play their high school positions necessarily. Like, I think Hulak ends up being a Viper at Notre Dame, and I think he's going to take some time to develop into that. Joseph Reef, is a defensive end. I wouldn't be surprised if he ends up being a defensive tackle at Notre Dame. So I guess you could classify those as developmental players, but I think what Notre Dame is going for is guys that they can build into something, and they're not afraid to sort of project two different positions that maybe they're not playing right away, because it's sort of natural that guys grow into the position that's a bigger size at the next level, and their speed can maybe translate better at that next position than if they stayed at that their high school position.
Here's another reason why I don't get too wound up about three stars. As long as Notre Dame believes in them and likes them, when you look at Notre Dame's draft class, now they're projected by Dane Brugler of The Athletic to have eight players drafted next weekend, not this coming weekend, but next weekend. When you look at it broken down by stars, you have Blake Fisher, who's a five star. You have Javonte Jean-Baptiste, who was a four. Audric Estime, who was a four. And then everybody else is a three star. Joe Alt, the two linebackers, Sam Hartman, Cam Hart. So, I mean, you have five three stars that are going to be drafted, and the three star designation is really guys that aren't supposed to be draft choices. So, Notre Dame thought they could develop those guys. Obviously, JJB and Hartman weren't their original recruits, but, so I don't get too wound up about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing that's difficult now with the transfer portal is it's hard to keep guys around to develop. So that could be a problem. That's something that Notre Dame is going to continue to have to work through. I think Notre Dame hopes that it's the ability to gain a degree from Notre Dame is something that is attractive to these recruits, and is a reason why they would stay and have the time to develop. But yeah, I mean, I think that you have to have those types of players in your class. And if you're a good program like Notre Dame, like look at Notre Dame going into the season. We're not expecting a lot of freshmen to impact Notre Dame this year, and they had a very good recruiting class. So I think if you're a good program, you don't need those guys to play right away. The challenge is, can you get those guys to build, buy in, and stick around long enough to sort of reap the rewards of their development later on? Next question is another one from Marie. If the NCAA does not ad or does adopt letting colleges directly deal NIL payments to players as is anticipated, how long do you think it will be here before Notre Dame starts paying recruits?
I think that might have passed officially today. I have not been as active on social media today as I could have been just because of the blue gold draft in this podcast. But I think Notre Dame will be in step with what's legal and what's happening on the NIL front. I know a lot of people were concerned that Notre Dame would get left behind in this NIL movement, and they've been able to do it within the rules, both what has existed up to this point, and I think as it evolves into the school being able to make direct payments, I still think the fund collective, that whole concept is going to be part of what Notre Dame does. So I don't see a concern there.
Yeah, I don't think it's, I guess maybe I don't understand what is being passed, but I still don't think this is like Notre Dame can write a check to X player out of the athletic department's funds and give it to them. My understanding of what this is that they're allowing them to schools to be part of the process of lining up NIL arrangements for players. And so whether that is being more directly involved with fund and sort of inter like making sure that people are talking to each other that need to talk to each other to make those things happen, whether it's brands that want someone, an athlete from Notre Dame, they can come directly to Notre Dame and say, hey, this is what we're looking for. Who do you think would be best for it? And Notre Dame can help process that. I my understanding, at least, I'd be curious if you know differently than me, Eric. I think they're still prohibiting like pay for play and schools like compensating student athletes directly for NIL, at least on paper. Like the rules aren't always followed, but I think that that's what's being proposed right
I have a headache. No, I'm just kidding.
now.
These are great questions, but I mean, it changes so fast. I think how Tyler characterized it is what the intent is now. Whether people are going to push that and circumvent it is a whole nother ball game. I think Notre Dame is going to be in step with what's legal, what's happening, and they are a player in the NIL space, and I don't think it's the concern people thought it would be, nor do I think it will be moving forward.
Yeah, the thing I described, I think, is something that's already happening in places and probably at Notre Dame. I don't think Notre Dame's going to do anything to delay assisting players when it comes to NIL. They might not be like, maybe if it comes to the day where like schools can literally pay for NIL, maybe Notre Dame has different opinions on that. But I don't think we're quite yet at what, at least it being described that way. But if it's a bunch of Notre Dame boosters giving that money through fund, like how different is that? So, I mean, I understand why people sort of can see the two things as being the same thing, but I think that Notre Dame, at least my understanding, is that they do still feel that there are important distinctions between what NIL is and should be still. All right, next question is from Mr. Nev at Mr. Irish Red. What is the definition of tampering? Seems like a lot is going on.
I would say when the school initiates the contact with a player who's not in the portal, that is tampering. There's third-party talks that can kind of circumvent that. But I mean, just going to somebody's active roster, even through a third party, I think, and saying, hey, we'd really love to have, let's say, what was the school that was made up? Anyways, let's say a fictitious school. Let's say Faber College,
Bishop Sycamore, right? Wasn't
Bishop
that
Sycamore. Let's say Bishop Sycamore says, we'd really love Steve Angeli to be our starting quarterback. And they reach out to his NIL rep or his aide Mickey there. If they reached out to him directly, that's even worse. And I was talking to somebody the other day, and it is very prevalent in women's basketball. And I think we've seen anecdotal evidence of this. Now, if the player, on the other hand, initiates the contact, even if he's not in the portal, I don't think that that's tampering. I think if they're, you know, if their NIL guy is out there looking, like if Steve Angeli has an NIL rep and says to Rutgers, hey, would you guys maybe think that Steve could be your starting quarterback? And I'm just making up a situation. I'm
no, it's okay.
Making up a situation. I think that's where it is. But again, a lot of these are even done before somebody gets in the portal. That's why you'll see some student athletes with do not contact tags, because right. They already know where they're going.
Yeah, I mean, technically it is against the rules for the athletes to reach out. I looked through the bylaws today trying to find stuff that was in the bylaws. It says student athletes may not speak to other schools about transferring directly or indirectly through others. And the examples listed are family members, scholastic or non-scholastic coach, advisor, former teammates, until they receive notice that they have been input into the transfer portal. Tampering actually isn't defined in the NCAA bylaws. I did a control F search for it. The only times the word tamper is used is related to drug testing samples. So it is happening abundantly. Let's be honest. How does Sam Hartman end up at Notre Dame so quickly? Like, there were conversations being had between people, whether or not they were supposed to or not supposed to, that allowed his recruitment to so quickly be known that, hey, once Sam Hartman's out of Wake Forest, he's going to Notre Dame. And this is just the reality of how college football is working. I don't always know who's talking to who or how that works, but that is the reality that we're dealing with. And that's why there is so much tampering, and then there will be coaches that complain about tampering, but no one's ever like using specific examples, because if you accuse someone of tampering, it's probably not going to be very hard for someone to find evidence that you have tampered with someone. So it's a lot of thieves sort of playing by the same honor code. And then every once in a while, someone gets upset, but they usually don't follow through on anything really happening with it. All right, our last question is Jack Quinn at JQ6008. What is Notre Dame's auto bid status to the 14-team playoff, and why hasn't that, along with other specifics, been announced yet?
If they're in the top 14, they're in. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. That's how that works. Pete Bavacqua, Notre Dame's new athletic director, acknowledged as much in our interview. Why not more details? Why haven't they been announced and all this stuff? Because they haven't worked everything out yet to everybody's satisfaction. It's still not a foregone conclusion that it is going to be a 14-team playoff. The 12 is still on the table. There's bickering and squabbling to do about automatic qualifiers. Once they get all that and they say, okay, yeah, we are going to do a 14-team playoff, until then, it still defaults back to the 12-team model we have now. But once they get that smoothed out, then that's when there will be a formal announcement.
Yeah, I think the only thing that's finalized that if I have my information correct, is there's a six-year agreement beginning in 2026 with ESPN to have the broadcast rights. And then with that came with it a revenue distribution model that was agreed to by all the players involved there. The format of the playoff is still under discussion. I know we've heard and it's been told that Notre Dame would have a spot as long as they're in the top 14. But if the format's not solidified yet, I don't really know. Can that be guaranteed if they haven't agreed on the format yet? It seems like that is the working belief and maybe handshake agreement of keeping Notre Dame involved with this. But yeah, I think we have to wait until everything is agreed to in terms of all the power players getting what they want out of this playoff format to know for certain how it's going to play out. But that is the expectation as we've covered. All right, that is it for today's episode of the Inside Indy Sports Podcast. If you don't already, you can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other popular podcast platforms. If you like what you hear, give us a star rating, leave a review, and share our podcast feed with someone who plans to attend Saturday's Blue Gold game. As I mentioned earlier, we have a subscription promo on InsideIndieSports.com that ends Monday. If you buy a one-month subscription to the site, you'll get 3 additional months for free by using the promo code NDSpring24. Football Never Sleeps will be back on YouTube on Monday, where we'll spin forward after the blue-gold game. We'll also have our post-game takeaways over on YouTube, too, this weekend. Then we'll be back maybe early in the week for a podcast, so stay tuned for that. We'll try to maybe preview next week's NFL draft. But until then, stick with InsideIndieSports.com for all your Notre Dame coverage needs.